It's Australian owned media corporation, and it really has taken away the independence of a lot of these publications. And naturally, in the digital age, paper readership is down. That's just going to be the case. And that's okay because there are so many avenues to get information to people digitally. A lot of people do still really want to read the written word, even if it's online, myself included. There's also a whole cohort of people who are voraciously consuming podcasts, also myself included. I'm not sure. Maybe I need to spend more time in quiet or something, but I like to consume media a lot. Then there's the people who are consuming news from oftentimes reputable reporters on TikTok, and this is just the nature of the modern age. I think that certain publications are slowly but surely coming around to that. Like, I know that the New York Times is creating more of a digital ecosystem than it ever has before. And when you subscribe to the New York Times, you get access to bonus podcasts on Spotify and things like that. So, in one way, it's just the natural order of things. And I think it's pretty cool that reporters are kind of scaling down, being more independent, and really taking the power back into their own hands.
Yeah. What's one thing that you're most proud of what you've reported on?
Well, I recently published an article on CNBC that focuses on how digital hiring assessments that people often have to take in order to even get to an interview stage in a company are largely not accessible for people with disabilities, despite the fact that many of them say they are. And I was able to speak to people with various disabilities, people who consult on this issue, people who research this issue, and figure out maybe what the next step is and why we need to restructure the digital hiring process. The interesting thing about that is that the Americans with Disability Act is, well, this year will be 30 years old. It wasn't until the last couple of decades that we've been living vastly online. And hiring online is even more recent. So, a lot of these problems that people face who have disabilities are actually newer, even though there is accessibility in a lot more ways than we maybe have known in the past. There's kind of new ways that we have to fight against bias as well.
That's so interesting. So, what is the advice that you'd give to so a young person, maybe someone in college like me, who might be interested in going into journalism?
My advice is that even if you feel like you don't have the expertise to be reporting on something, just go for it anyway and ask a lot of questions. People get really excited when they're given the opportunity to answer questions, even if they might not seem like it at first. All you have to do is say, "I'm a reporter. Can I ask you some questions for such and such?" Usually, they let their guard down pretty quickly, even if there is a hesitancy at first, and it ends up working out really well. I would say don't be afraid to push the status quo and ask the hard questions. I feel like a lot of the advice I'm giving is just don't be afraid, don't be afraid. But despite the fact that the college experience gives you an opportunity to step outside of the box and try new things, there are ways that that opportunity may also try to confine you to pursue a certain path. And you really don't have to do that path if you don't want to. You can choose your own. And there's more options now than ever. You can work fully online, you can work remote from a post in Bali if you want. You don't have to do that forever, but I think it's, after college, it's always a good time to try something like that. So I'll just say, feel free to connect with me on LinkedIn. My name is Rachel Curry. I'm pretty active on there. I do have my newsletter called Acronym, which I'll be posting about all the time. And if you feel like you have a lead for a story, feel free to send me a message.
Thank you. So yeah, this has been Forbes Avenue on WRCT Pittsburgh. I'm Rihanna Duncan, and I've been interviewing Rachel Curry. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
Before we get started, I'd like to remind you that the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of WRCT Pittsburgh and its members.
From New York, this is Democracy Now! The
I'll be
U.S.
dealing with
Attorney
President.
for New York and five Justice Department officials have resigned, refusing to dismiss the Justice Department's corruption charges against New York City Mayor Eric Adams. Then to the Munich Security Conference in Germany.
Be dealing with President Putin largely on the phone, and we ultimately expect to meet. In fact, we expect that he'll come here and I'll go there.
Nothing should be decided about Ukraine without the Ukrainians, and nothing about Europe without the Europeans. That is a given.
Vice President J.D. Vance and Secretary of State Marco Rubio are expected to meet with Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky in Munich. We'll go there for the latest on the conference and the protests against it. We'll speak with former Greek Finance Minister Yanis Varoufakis. And today is Valentine's Day. We'll speak with a reporter and OkCupid security whistleblower behind a major new investigation, Rape Under Wraps: How Tinder, Hinge, and their corporate owner, Match.com, chose profits over safety. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. A federal judge ordered the Trump administration to restore U.S. funding for foreign aid. Judge Amir Ali, a Biden appointee, said Trump's executive order set off a shockwave for aid groups that relied on the money, which had already been appropriated by Congress. Lawyers argued the blanket freeze harmed both recipients of the aid and U.S. businesses and organizations that provide it, arguing before the court, quote, businesses are shuttering, terminating employees, food is rotting, medication expiring. A group of 14 states have sued Donald Trump and Elon Musk, accusing the president of giving the world's richest man seemingly limitless and unchecked power to dismantle federal agencies, saying it's, quote, antithetical to the nation's entire constitutional structure, unquote. Earlier this week, President Trump signed an executive order to expand the power of Musk's so-called Department of Government Efficiency, or DOGE. The lawsuit comes as the Trump administration fired thousands of workers, including at the Departments of Education, Energy, and Veterans Affairs, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, the Office of Personnel Management, the Environmental Protection Agency, the General Services Administration, and the Small Business Administration. On Thursday, Musk said the Trump administration should, quote, delete entire agencies, unquote, from the federal government. Fired federal workers at the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau took part in a protest Wednesday outside the agency's headquarters in Washington, D.C., which have been closed all week.
The CFPB gets money back from consumers who've been screwed by banks and other financial institutions. Call your congressional representatives and say that you care about the CFPB continuing to exist.
The Trump administration's continuing to attack judges who rule against President Trump's executive actions. On Thursday, Elon Musk expressed support for impeaching the judge who blocked the president's funding freeze. Meanwhile, the American Bar Association's warned the rule of law and the nation's constitutional system are under attack. The U.S. Senate confirmed Robert F. Kennedy Jr. as health secretary Thursday, handing him control of 13 federal agencies, including the CDC, FDA, and National Institutes of Health, and oversight over Medicare and Medicaid. Democrats repeatedly warned against RFK Jr.'s confirmation, citing his espousal of vaccine conspiracy theories, including one linking vaccines to autism. The only Republican to vote against Kennedy was Senator Mitch McConnell, a survivor of polio. He said, quote, "I will not condone the relitigation of proven cures," unquote. Trump later attacked McConnell and cast doubt on whether he ever had polio. RFK Jr. will control nearly $2 trillion in health spending. After his confirmation, RFK Jr. said he expects major staffing cuts at federal health agencies. On the same day as Kennedy's confirmation and swearing in, Louisiana's top health official announced Louisiana will no longer promote mass vaccination. Also Thursday, Democratic senators grilled Linda McMahon, Trump's pick to lead the Education Department, which Trump has repeatedly threatened to shut down. McMahon, the former CEO of World Wrestling Entertainment, was questioned by Connecticut Democrat Chris Murphy on Trump's order banning diversity, equity, and inclusion, DEI.
My son is in a public school. He takes a class called African American History. If you're running an African American History class, could you perhaps be in violation of this court order, of this executive order?
I'm not quite certain, and I'd like to look into it further and get back to you on that.
McMahon's hearing was interrupted by multiple protesters, including one who warned that the People with Disabilities Education Act, that's the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act, is under threat. In other cabinet news, the Senate has confirmed Brooke Rollins as Agriculture Secretary, and the Senate Judiciary Committee has advanced Kash Patel's confirmation to head the FBI. Lee Zeldin, the new head of the Environmental Protection Agency, is attempting to rescind $20 billion in grants for climate and clean energy projects that have been awarded by the Biden administration. The money was set to go to the Greenhouse Gas Reduction Fund, known as the Green Bank, and fund projects benefiting disadvantaged communities. Zeldin also canceled a $50 million grant to the Climate Justice Alliance. The Biden administration had allocated the funding to the group, but later withheld it after CJA accused Israel of committing genocide in Gaza, allowing Trump's EPA to permanently cancel the grant. The top federal prosecutor in New York, the interim U.S. attorney, and five other high-ranking Justice Department officials have resigned to protest the Trump administration's order to dismiss corruption charges against New York City Mayor Eric Adams. In a letter, the acting interim U.S. attorney for the Southern District of New York, Danielle Sassoon, said dropping the case against Adams would be, quote, inconsistent with my ability and duty to prosecute federal crimes without fear or favor and to advance good faith arguments before the courts, unquote. In her letter, Sassoon, who'd been appointed by Trump, went on to accuse Adams of promising to help Trump's immigration crackdown in exchange for the charges being dropped. After Sassoon refused to drop the charges, Justice Department officials moved the case to another division, leading to more resignations. Earlier Thursday, Adams met with Trump's so-called border czar, Tom Homan, to discuss plans to reopen an ICE office inside New York's Riker Island jail complex. Protesters rallied in the streets in response. This is a Nicaraguan asylum seeker.
I'm a Nicaraguan citizen. I came to this country looking for opportunity, the opportunity that was taken away from me in my country, the opportunity for freedom of speech and to work here and to be a contributing citizen. The U.S. has taken away the liberty that Nicaragua has also taken away.
The Trump-appointed U.S. attorney who resigned, Danielle Sassoon, was a Federalist Society member and a law clerk for Justice Antonin Scalia. In related news, the Trump administration has taken back $80 million that FEMA had given New York City to cover the hotel costs for asylum seekers. New York's controller, Brad Lander, accused Elon Musk of highway robbery. Earlier this week, Musk lashed out at the use of federal dollars to provide temporary shelter to asylum seekers, falsely claiming immigrants were staying in luxury hotels. Meanwhile, in Colorado, Denver's public school district has become the first in the nation to sue Trump over its policy allowing Immigration and Customs Enforcement, ICE, to conduct raids at schools, which caused attendance to plummet. Ukraine has accused Russia of a drone attack on the Chernobyl nuclear plant. The attack sparked a fire, but Ukraine says radiation levels remain normal. This comes as Vice President J.D. Vance is meeting with Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky at the Munich Security Conference today. Vance told the Wall Street Journal the U.S. could slap Moscow with sanctions and even use, quote, military tools of leverage, unquote, if Vladimir Putin does not agree to a deal guaranteeing Ukraine's long-term independence. On Thursday, Trump said Ukraine would, of course, have a role in negotiations after evading a reporter question earlier this week on whether he saw Kyiv as an equal member of possible peace talks. In more foreign policy news, Trump has proposed talks with China and Russia aimed at the nuclear stockpiles and slashing all three of the country's military budgets in half, including the U.S. President Trump announced Thursday he's moving to impose reciprocal tariffs on trading partners across the globe, including longtime U.S. allies. He made the announcement ahead of a visit from Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi at the White House. During a joint news conference with Modi Thursday, Trump said the U.S. is increasing military sales to India, including the eventual sale of F-35 fighter jets. In Sudan, witnesses say the Rapid Support Forces stormed the country's largest camp for displaced people, looting and setting fires to homes in a market. The Zamzam camp in North Darfur has been repeatedly attacked since late last year. The RSF denied the reports about 500,000 displaced people who are suffering from famine live in the camp. The latest attack forced thousands of them to flee again. Doctors Without Borders said at least seven people were killed. In the Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo, armed groups are subjecting children to sexual violence, including rape. That's according to UNICEF, which has warned the targeting of children by armed groups has soared to unprecedented levels. UNICEF says it's received at least 170 reports of rape involving children. One mother told UNICEF her six daughters, the youngest 12 years old, were raped by armed men while searching for food. Mexican President Claudia Sheinbaum says she's considering legal action against Google if Google refuses to reverse its renaming of the Gulf of Mexico as the Gulf of America on Google Maps.
The only place where the United States can call it something different is where it exercises sovereignty, and that's 22 nautical miles from the coast in its territory. So Google is wrong.
Protesters in Bolivia disrupted a government conference Thursday that was discussing lithium contracts with Chinese and Russian businesses. Bolivians say the country's lithium, the largest reserves in the world, should benefit the people of Bolivia and that deals were made without legally required consultation with indigenous communities. Lithium exploitation leads to soil degradation, water shortages, and disrupts local ecosystems. Last year was the deadliest for journalists. That's according to the Committee to Protect Journalists, which reports at least 124 journalists and media workers were killed in 2024. Nearly two-thirds of them Palestinian journalists killed by Israel. The CPJ also cites the high number of journalist deaths due to conflicts in Sudan, Pakistan, and Burma, also known as Myanmar. A federal judge temporarily blocked Trump's executive order attempting to shut down nationwide access to gender-affirming care for transgender minors. The judge's order prohibits federal agencies from conditioning or withholding funding to health care providers and institutions that provide the care. Kansas's Democratic Governor Laura Kelly vetoed a proposal to ban gender-affirming care for transgender youth for the third straight year. Thus far, Kansas Republicans have failed to overrule Kelly's veto. Meanwhile, in New Hampshire, two trans high school athletes are legally challenging Trump's order banning trans girls and women from competing in school sports. The city of Worcester, Massachusetts, passed a resolution designating itself a sanctuary city for the transgender community. Here in New York, protesters are gathering at the historic Stonewall Inn today at noon after the National Park Service attempted to erase trans and queer people from its history by removing the letters T and Q from references to LGBTQ plus people from the Stonewall National Monument website. The Stonewall Rebellion was led in part by Sylvia Rivera and Marsha P. Johnson, both transgender activists of color. A Texas judge ordered New York doctor Margaret Carpenter to stop prescribing and sending abortion pills to Texas patients and fined her $100,000. The case is expected to make its way to the Supreme Court in what would be a major test to shield laws that protect abortion providers nationwide. Meanwhile, New York Governor Kathy Hochul rejected an extradition request from Louisiana's attorney general for the same doctor, citing New York shield laws. Dr. Carpenter was indicted in Louisiana for prescribing abortion pills to a patient there online. And Senator Bernie Sanders is launching a national tour to fight oligarchy, starting with stops in Omaha, Nebraska, and Iowa City next week to speak with working-class Americans who voted for Trump.
The oligarch's nightmare is that we will not allow ourselves to be divided up by race, religion, sexual orientation, or country of origin, and will together have the courage to take them on.
And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We begin today's show here in New York, where the top federal prosecutor and five other high-ranking Justice Department officials have resigned, refusing to implement the Trump administration's order to dismiss corruption charges against New York City Mayor Eric Adams. In a stunning letter, the acting interim U.S. Attorney for the Southern District of New York, Danielle Sassoon, said dropping the case against Mayor Adams would be, quote, inconsistent with my ability and duty to prosecute federal crimes without fear or favor and to advance good faith arguments before the courts, unquote. Sassoon was appointed by Trump, is a longtime member of the Federalist Society, and she clerked for Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia. Sassoon's letter was addressed to Acting Deputy Attorney General Emil Bovee, who was one of President Trump's defense attorneys in his New York State criminal trial last year. Bovee sent the memo Monday ordering the charges to be dismissed because they, quote, unduly restricted Mayor Adams' ability to devote full attention and resources, unquote, to help with Trump's immigration crackdown. In her letter, Sassoon said Adams and his lawyers, quote, repeatedly urged what amounted to a quid pro quo. After Sassoon refused to drop the charges, Justice Department officials moved the case from New York to the Public Integrity Section in the Criminal Division of the Justice Department that led to more prosecutors resigning. This all came after Adams met Thursday with Trump's so-called border czar, Tom Homan, to discuss the possible reopening of an ICE office inside New York's Rikers Island jail. Protesters rallied in Manhattan to condemn ICE. This is a Nicaraguan asylum seeker.
I'm a Nicaraguan citizen. I came to this country looking for opportunity, the opportunity that was taken away from me in my country, the opportunity for freedom of speech and to work here and to be a contributing citizen. The U.S. has taken away the liberty that Nicaragua has also taken away. All I ask for is freedom.
For more, we're joined by Ron Kuby, criminal defense and civil rights lawyer based here in New York. Well, this is amazing. It seems to be almost an echo of the Saturday Night Massacre when Nixon tried to get his way with the Justice Department. We'll talk about that in a minute. But explain the significance of the interim U.S. attorney in New York, the Southern District, often called the Sovereign District, and the significance of that. Her resigning followed by five other top attorneys.
Well, at the outset, it's an illustration that you don't have to comply under these circumstances. Rather than become a Trump toady, which is one option, you can quit your job. And obviously, Danielle Sassoon has many other opportunities awaiting her. She was clearly a rising star on the right until she ran afoul of the Trump administration on this issue. And so it's a good illustration for people who are considering their career over the next 4 years, for them to say, federal prosecutors to say, you know what, I'm just not going to go along with this. I am going to resign. I'm not going to carry out these duties. And it illustrates sort of a hollowing out of the more competent attorneys in the Justice Department, which just makes it that much harder for the Trump administration to sort of carry out its agenda against activists, against public officials, and against other people who cross it.
I mean, this is amazing. In her letter to Attorney General Pamela Bondi a day before, Sassoon argued the law doesn't support a dismissal, adding she's confident that Adams has committed the crimes with which he's charged. She also accused Adams' lawyers of, quote, repeatedly urged what amounted to a quid pro quo, indicating Adams would be in a position to assist with the department's enforcement priorities only if the indictment was dismissed. Explain what it means to be dismissed without prejudice, that every day, if Adams doesn't do what Trump wants, for example, around immigration, the case could be brought back against him.
That's right. This is the sort of club hanging over the head of Mayor Adams throughout the rest of his tenure as mayor. And even if he does do what they want, they could still bring back the charges. This is not an administration that's known for its consistency or loyalty. But clearly he knows that he has to get on board. Otherwise, he may be on a train to some federal prison. And that's explicit in the directions given by the Justice Department. And you can see Adams racing to comply. I mean, the quo was being supplied really fast after the quid here.
I mean, that's really important. Yesterday, you have Sassoon saying this is a quid pro quo. And she said the top Justice Department official under Bondi, right? And let's remember, Emil Bovey was the personal attorney for Trump, as well as the man who looks like he's about to be confirmed, who will be right above him, Todd Blanche, in a meeting, who took away the notes of the lawyers who took notes. She said it was extremely clear that he wanted Adams to engage in the quid pro quo. So yesterday you have a meeting with Homan saying he's instituting an ICE office in Rikers Island.
So the Justice Department historically has always carried out the policies of the President of the United States. You go all the way back to the 50s during the Red Scare. The Southern District executed the Rosenbergs. You can go through COINTELPRO in the 60s. In the 80s, the sanctuary prosecutions initiated by Reagan, Bush's invasion of Panama to arrest Manuel Noriega. You know, some administrations do more, some administrations do less, but it's always political. So, you know, to that extent, this is not unusual. But what makes this different is it's explicit. At least in the past, the Justice Department went to pains to say this is not a political decision. We are making these decisions solely on the basis of the law. We don't initiate or decline prosecutions based on the political policies of the people who are being targeted, et cetera, et cetera. There's no fig leaf anymore.
So let's go back to what was known as the Saturday Night Massacre. During a single evening on Saturday, October 20th, 1973, Nixon ordered Attorney General Elliot Richardson to fire Archibald Cox, who was the special prosecutor investigating Watergate. Richardson refused and resigned. So Nixon then ordered Deputy Attorney General William Ruckelshaus to fire Cox. He refused. And then he ordered the Solicitor General Robert Bork to fire Cox. He agreed.
And Robert Bork never lived down that particular bit of ignominy. That's the reason he never became a Supreme Court justice, because of his role in that. And here, eventually, sooner or later, as you go through the Southern District, you will find some lawyer willing to file a motion with the court to dismiss these charges.
So they might file. I mean, it could be Emil Bovey himself or some guy from or woman from somewhere else in the country who comes in to argue. But couldn't the judge refuse?
In theory, the judge could refuse to dismiss the charges, because that's always up to judicial discretion. But if the judge refuses, then what? The Justice Department says, we are not prosecuting, we are not going forward, so okay, dismiss, don't dismiss, but nothing is happening with this case, and eventually the defense would move to dismiss on speedy trial grounds, and that would have to be granted. So this is effectively going to be the end of the case once the administration finds somebody sufficiently spineless to actually file the papers.
So New York City doesn't have a recall, but New York Governor Kathy Hochul has the power to remove New York City Mayor Eric Adams. She spoke on MSNBC on Rachel Maddow's show last night.
This is not supposed to happen in our system of justice. The Bondi administration in that Department of Justice is already showing they're corrupt. Now, set that aside. I did see the letter. that was issued by the acting United States attorney. The allegations are extremely concerning and serious.
Yes.
But I cannot, as the governor of this state, have a knee-jerk, politically motivated reaction like a lot of other people are saying right now. I have to do it smart, what's right, and I'm consulting with other leaders in government at this time.
So, Ron Kuby, your response to the governor, what does that mean?
Yeah, it means I'm not removing him now. I may remove him in the future. I may not. I have to have a lot of discussions and conferences. You don't want me just going off and doing something like that just because of all of this, the kind of unraveling of the rule of law. I need to take some time and think. It doesn't mean anything. It's sort of typical Governor Hochul when she's confronted with an unpleasant reality.
Well, we will see what happens and, of course, follow it in the coming days. Ron Kuby, criminal defense and civil rights lawyer based here in New York. Next up to Germany, where protests are planned against the Munich Security Conference. Vice President Vance is there. U.S. Secretary of State Marco Rubio is there. We'll speak with the former Greek finance minister who will be leading one of the protests. Stay with us.
I was in the kitchen. Daddy's on the phone and nobody knows what's going on. But I've got them so long to see you, 'cause my Buick's outside red and blue. One for the money, honey. Two for the show, and it's three to get ready. Tom's gotta go, he's got them. So long I see you, 'cause my Buick's outside red and blue. Ooh, well, bye bye bye, yeah. Bye bye bye.
So Long, I'll See Ya by Tom Waits. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, War, Peace, and the Presidency. I'm Amy Goodman. We turn now to Munich, Germany, where a high-level security conference with dozens of world leaders is underway. At the top of the agenda, Russia-Ukraine war. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky is expected to meet with Vice President J.D. Vance and Secretary of State Marco Rubio today. Earlier this week, President Trump said he would hold bilateral talks with Russian President Vladimir Putin to end the nearly three-year long war. The announcement stoked fears in Europe that Ukraine would be sidelined in the talks. This is the German Chancellor, Olaf Scholz, speaking last night at a news conference in Berlin.
Nothing should be decided about Ukraine without the Ukrainians, and nothing about Europe without the Europeans. That is a given. We agree on this with all our friends and partners in Europe.
Eines ist für mich völlig klar.
One thing is absolutely clear to me. Any negotiated solution must enable Ukraine to have armed forces at its disposal in the future that can repel any renewed Russian attack. This is a considerable challenge financially, materially, and logistically. This would exceed Ukraine's financial capabilities for the foreseeable future. We Europeans and our transatlantic and international partners are needed here.
On Thursday, President Trump walked back his initial comments and told reporters Ukraine would, of course, be a party to talks with Russia. Vice President J.D. Vance told the Wall Street Journal that the U.S. could slap Moscow with sanctions and even use, quote, military tools of leverage if Vladimir Putin does not agree to a deal guaranteeing Ukraine's long-term independence. Vance told the Wall Street Journal he plans to tell European leaders to embrace populist parties, stop mass migration, and curb progressive policies. Vance will not be meeting with the German chancellor, who's the host of the conference. Meanwhile, over 40 protest rallies are planned against the security conference in Munich this weekend. For more, we're joined in Munich by two guests. Melanie Schweitzer is a lawyer who works at the German Ministry of Labor and Social Affairs, a member of the progressive party Mira 25, running for a parliamentary seat in the elections later this month. And we're joined by Yanis Varoufakis, former finance minister of Greece. His most recent book, Techno-Feudalism, What Killed Capitalism. He's scheduled to speak at one of the protest rallies in Munich Saturday. Their slogan, peace-capable instead of war-capable. Yanis Varoufakis, we'll start with you. What exactly does that mean? And what is your overall message in Munich right now, where you have the new vice president of the United States and new secretary of state? Of course, they're not the only members. The message, the top story now is the Russia-Ukraine war.
Well, Amy, Europe used to be a wonderful peace project. The whole point of bringing together different nations into the European Union was supposedly to make sure that there would be no more war in Europe. Unfortunately, cornered by two different authoritarianism, the authoritarianism of Putin on the one hand and the expansionary warmongering forces within the US-led NATO alliance, Europe has been caught in a frenzy of warmongering, essentially. To think about it, Amy, that our, that is the European Union's chief defense and security spokesperson, the former prime minister of Estonia, Kaja Kallas, only 2 weeks before she got this position, had advocated the breakdown and the breakup of the Russian Federation. This was like a call for war. So we are here in Munich to demonstrate this conversion of the European Union into a war union. And don't forget that this Munich Security Conference, so to speak, is effectively a very bizarre bazaar for weaponry. All the most ambitious war merchants and arms dealers of the world have gathered here supposedly to discuss peace. We're here in order to impose a peace narrative upon them.
Can you talk about what Trump is talking about with making a proposal around the nuclear stockpiles of China, Russia, and the United States, Yanis?
Well, Trump's motives are always suspect, and his negotiations may come to naught. But the idea of a negotiated climb down from the heights of this nuclear confrontation. Remember that the nuclear clock is very, very close to midnight now. The nearest it has been in the last 50 or 60 years. That is not a bad idea, to have this kind of tripolar, if you want, tri-party negotiation. But of course, who knows what that might lead to, given that Donald Trump is constantly flooding the zone with uncertainty for a number of very, very suspect objectives.
I want to bring Melanie Schweitzer in this conversation, member of the Progressive Party, Mira 25, running for a parliamentary seat in the elections later this month. I said that you worked for a lawyer working for the German Ministry of Labor and Social Affairs. Can you talk about the pressure you've been under and what's happened?
Yes, thank you very much. Hi, Amy. Thank you for giving us space to speak here. I think the situation in Germany at the moment is really dire. There is a blatant attack of on freedom of speech, freedom of assembly. We see a dismantling of the rule of law in Germany at the moment, a crisis of democracy, and we really very much fear the upcoming elections in 10 days. And we actually think that this might be the last election before fascism, because the center parties, especially the Social Democrats, the Green Party, also the Left Party, have taken over the rhetoric of the far right, not just the rhetoric, but also the policies. So they have made two new resolutions against freedom of speech. They have banned Francesca Albanese from speaking in at universities this and next week, the politicians. So they have done a crackdown on the protests and anti-war movement, anti-genocide violence movement. Last week, it was banned to talk any language except English and German, and that was due to lies spread by Axel Springer, the biggest right-wing newspaper in Germany that is constantly going after people, doxing people. So anyone basically who speaks out in Germany at the moment against the Israeli war crimes against the government is being subjected to political repression and also private and political doxing where people lose their jobs. But when on the other side, you can express genocidal rhetoric without fearing any consequences. So this is why I'm a candidate. This is why I became politically active, because I think this is really very serious. And as a German with a German history, you know, I feel compelled to speak up when in the face of oppression and injustice, and especially being a lawyer, being trained to uphold the constitution and thereby international law. And just to give you two recent examples of like how this is being normalized here, this hate speech. There was just recently a Jewish person, a journalist, being accused of indictment of hatred because he was simply saying a sentence that we as Jewish, we are not victims, you know. So whenever someone speaks up against this whole witch hunt, they become prosecuted. And then just yesterday, the Ministry of Interior tweeted a tweet proudly saying that now in Germany, we're the only country who deports people to Afghanistan. And they were proud about this. And there was a huge backlash about this post, that how can you be proud as a European country to deport to Afghanistan? And they were saying where the Taliban is ruling, you know. And today the chancellor was giving an interview, and the journalist was asking him, so what do you do, you know, if the International Criminal Court comes to the conclusion that this was genocide in Gaza? And he said, I'm not going to answer these questions. It's not possible. It will not happen. And he said, it's absurd. It's just not going to happen, you know. And
Melanie Schweitzer, have you been suspended from the German Ministry of Labor and Social Affairs?
Yes, actually, I have. So I had been voicing my opinion and this on Twitter with my name, and then I had been doxxed and found out that I was working at the ministry. And then I was on holidays in December, and as soon as I was supposed to come back in January, I was suspended from work with immediate effect. So ever since this newspaper article from Axel Springer and Bild-Zeitung came out, I never set one foot again into the ministry. And I still have no idea why, actually, because I was, the only thing that I am aware of is that I was expressing my opinion about the ongoing genocide, and that I'm not, that this has to stop, and that Germany has to stop delivering weapons, and that there have to be sanctions against Israel.
I wanted to go back to Yanis Varoufakis and talk about Elon Musk. Some are calling him the ex-president, not the former president of the United States, but the letter X, as he owns one of the largest, obviously, social media platforms in the world, X, and stands next to the president in the Oval Office, seems to be making a lot of the decisions. Also, leading meeting with foreign leaders, and in Germany, just held this two-hour freewheeling conversation with AfD, supports AfD. If you could describe this part in Germany that has risen so rapidly, would you describe it as a neo-Nazi party, and the role, as you talk about techno-feudalism, of Elon Musk?
Well, to begin with the Alternative for Deutschland, the Alternative for Germany, it is a party which started life as a Eurosceptic party against the idea of a common currency. It used many tropes and many turns of phrase that alluded to a Nazi past. It would be wrong to call it a Nazi party or a neo-Nazi party. It would be right to refer to them as an ultra-conservative, racist, xenophobic party, which alludes to the dark era of the Nazi period. Regarding Musk as a techno-feudal lord, you have to remember that Musk is one of the latecomers to what I call techno-feudalism. Jeff Bezos, Mark Zuckerberg, Google, Microsoft were the pioneers of techno-feudalism. They created these digital fiefdoms in which were encased. And, there is massive exploitation of everyone, of people who sell stuff on Amazon, of newspapers and media outlets like your good selves, whose work is being usurped. But Musk was a standard capitalist. He was producing cars. He was producing rockets, not a very standard product, but nevertheless, industrial era product. And then he jumps on the bandwagon of Twitter. He buys it because he wants to connect his capitalist empire with what I call cloud capital, with this algorithmic capital, which has this remarkable capacity to alter our behavior, to modify our behavior. And anyone who owns that capacity, that power, and that capital, that cloud capital, can extract huge rents from the rest of society. And then very quickly, he decided to do that which Robert Barons always did in the past, which is, of course, to cozy up to government and to gain access directly to political power. So he's a latecomer, but he does move quite quickly, doesn't he?
Well, I wanted to read to you from Reuters and the Wall Street Journal. The man likely to become Germany's next leader warned Elon Musk would face consequences for boosting the far-right AfD, Alternative for Germany, through his ex-social media platform. Friedrich Merz said, "What happened in this election campaign cannot go unchallenged." Merz, the front-runner in the polls ahead of the February 23rd election, told the Wall Street Journal, referring to what he sees as Musk's interference in Germany's election. Musk repeatedly calling on X for Germans to vote for AfD, saying it could save the country. And your response, for example, when you're looking at Germany right now and you look at what's happened in the United States, that Nazi salute that that Elon Musk gave several times at a Trump rally.
Well, it's mind-boggling that we should be witnessing these scenes today, especially from the South African mafia behind the PayPal mafia. Remember, people who grew up with apartheid in their heads. But allow me to make a comment about Friedrich Merz, who will be the next Chancellor of Germany, according to the opinion polls, and whom you mentioned as having turned against Elon Musk and having accused Elon Musk, quite correctly, for giving a platform to the leader of the Alternative for Deutschland, for Germany. Mr. Merz, even though he's right in putting forward that criticism, is perhaps the epitome of hypocrisy. Because you may have heard that only, 10 days ago, it was he, as the leader of the Christian Democratic Party, that is the leading party in Germany, that went into bed, proverbially, with the Alternative for Deutschland in the parliament of the Federal Republic of Germany in order to pass together his Christian Democratic Union Party and the Alternative for Germany, to pass together a xenophobic, racist, toxic bill that was turning against asylum seekers. So this very same man who is going to be the Chancellor of Germany, who is accusing Elon Musk of giving a platform to the ultra-right of the Alternative for Germany, is the one that has already gone into political bet with the Alternative for Germany. This is what we've come to. We are now caught up in this agglomeration, in this unholy alliance between the center-right and the ultra-right. And I very much fear that after the federal election, in exactly the same way that we've already seen it in Austria, we've seen it in the Netherlands, the ultra-right and the center-right are going to be pushing the political spectrum deeper and deeper into the territory of weaponized misanthropy.
And Melanie Schweitzer, you're running in these elections for the Progressive Party Mira 25, which is new. Explain what it is and the significance of Elon Musk's support and the rise of AfD.
Yes, so Mira 25 is a relatively new party. It was established in Germany in 2021, so this is the first federal election that we are taking part in. It is a socialist, internationalist, anti-imperialist party that is founded, also has behind the movement, the European movement of democracy. 25, so DiEM25, and it is a party that is firmly against militarization, and we believe that we need a movement politically and outside of politics to combat that warmongering that we are seeing, the rhetoric, this preparation of war that feels more and more like 1984, the book, you know. And so what we see here is also, it's an instrumentalization of our past, of our history. history, you know. So anti-Semitism and reason of state are used to instrumentalize and to weaponize against people who are against this war machine, you know. So we are being, we are called radicals for wanting to an end to the violence, for wanting to end weapons delivery. So, you know, between 60 and 70% of the Germans do not want weapons deliveries to Israel anymore. And all the parties that are in the in parliament want that actually and support it. So they are not, they do not respect what their voters want, and they do actually not represent them. And, you know, the same goes with nowadays, it is common sense in Germany that anti-Semitism is an Arab issue, when actually, and you know, that somehow we have abhorred our history with that. And then it comes that Elon Musk with a Nazi salute, this is being downplayed and not called was it what it is. But when people in Germany speak up for the rights of the Palestinian people, their right to life, the right to dignity, they are called anti-Semite. So what we see now is it's really, we see fascism playing out in real time, and it's getting worse by the day, and it's really worrying and concerning. And it also appears, you know, the media is very much complicit in this. So they would ask, for example, because we are completely anti this movement, they don't give us any space to talk. They don't give us coverage for the upcoming elections. So we as a party that is against this this war movement are being marginalized and actually threatened by the police as well. We have been told that we have to inform them if we do any political activity beforehand the elections in Berlin. So yeah, it's just and Musk working together with the AfD is so very telling about the global developments as well. We are globally going into fascism, and that's why all the, and the Israeli government at the moment, we can also tell very clearly it's a right-wing fascist government. So this all goes hand in hand together.
Melanie Schweitzer, we want to thank you for being with us, member of the Progressive Party, Mira 25, running for a parliamentary seat in the elections later this month. Yanis Varoufakis, former Greek foreign minister, both in Munich. Yanis Varoufakis is leading one of the protests tomorrow. Next up, well, today is Valentine's Day. We're going to speak with a reporter and an OKCupid security whistleblower behind a major new investigation, Rape Under Wraps, How Tinder, Hinge, and Their Corporate Owner, Match.com, Chose Profits Over Safety. Stay with us. You by Solange. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Today's Valentine's Day. We end the show with a reporter and a whistleblower behind a major new investigation headlined Rape Under Wraps, How Tinder, Hinge, and Their Corporate Owner Chose Profits Over Safety. This is how it opens. When a young woman in Denver met up with a smiling cardiologist she matched with on the dating app Hinge, she had no way of knowing that the company behind the app had already received reports from two other women who had accused him of rape. She met the 34-year-old doctor with green eyes and thinning hair at Highland Tappan Burger, a sports bar in a trendy neighborhood. It went well enough that she accepted an invitation to go back to his apartment. As she emerged from his bathroom, he handed her a tequila soda. What transpired over the next 24 hours, according to court testimony, reads like every person's dating app nightmare. We pick up the story from there with Emily Elena Dugdale, independent investigative journalist, part of the Dating Apps Reporting Project, an 18-month investigation with the Pulitzer Center's AI Accountability Network, and The Markup. now a part of Cal Matters, which just co-published this major new report with The Guardian, as well as The 19th. We're also joined by Michael Lowry, former head of user safety and advocacy at OkCupid. He worked for Match Group for nearly a decade, leading a safety team for OkCupid. But he left there in 2022, became a whistleblower, is featured in this new report. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Emily, lay out what you found about Match Group, which runs half the world's online dating market with dating apps like Tinder, Hinge, and 190 countries used by millions. What happened to that woman in Denver?
Yeah, so unfortunately, the woman in Denver was one of many women who were sexually assaulted, drugged, or raped by Stephen Matthews, who's the cardiologist that you read at the beginning of this report. And like we open, Match Group was aware of the conduct of this person. He had been reported multiple times to the app and yet continued to match with women on these apps, take them to his apartment, drug, and rape them. So we found basically that Match Group is aware of a lot of the scale of harm on their apps. They actually track this on their back end. And in 2020, they promised to make more data available about the harm that's happening on their platforms, but that's never happened. And so really what we're seeing, and we'll talk to Michael a little bit about this, I'm sure, is that they are really choosing a profit model over the safety and security of their users.
So in that case, ultimately, how did the rapist get caught? If woman after woman reported that they were raped or he attempted to rape them, to when they would report this to the dating app, when they reported this, for example, to Hinge.
So this, you know, one of his, the survivors of this attack actually went to the police. It wasn't until that point when he literally could not have a phone any longer that he was off the app. And so we saw again that multiple times this person was able to, after being reported, continue to meet women. The only reason he stopped was because someone went to the police and finally told their story.
So it wasn't anything to do with reporting from the apps. It was a woman went straight to the police.
That's correct, yes.
And then one woman after another came forward after that. Are they suing Hinge? Are they suing Match Group?
So at this point, you know, there's not anything that we know of that is happening in that front. But, you know, this man, Stephen Matthews, was recently convicted and was, you know, convicted of, he's going to be in prison for a long time. 158 years is the sentence that was handed down.
Are there any federal regulations to hold these dating apps accountable? What does it mean if you report to Hinge, if you report to Match.com and you say you were attacked, you say something happened to you? What are they doing with the information?
Yeah, so I think similar to many tech companies, you know, there's really little regulation that requires them to actually tell you what's going on their apps and this on or off platform harm. And so really what we saw was that the company was taking, you know, down information about people who are reported for harm on the apps. They are keeping that on their back end. But unfortunately, since it's so easy to actually get back onto these apps after being banned, it didn't really matter. Somebody could get banned and then come back on pretty much instantly with the same name, profile information, birth date. And so, you know, the security measures that they have in place really don't prevent somebody from coming back on and doing harm.
Michael Lowry, your former OkCupid head of user safety. You decided to become a whistleblower. Why?
I was seeing a lot of stuff. I mean, one of the reasons I left was because I kept putting forward new safety proposals and trying to convince Match Group to stop gutting my team of humans and trying to switch to automation or outsourcing. So it became impossible for me to carry on working there ethically and morally after a time. So I thought for at least 2 extra years and I should have stayed, I could change it. But it just wasn't possible. They weren't listening. Bottom line was always the problem. Every time somebody left, that job would be passed on to my workload. So we just weren't rehiring people to fill the teams.
Michael, you have called these apps playgrounds for predators. You say Match invested something like $100 million in safety measures, but you call this safety theater. Did you get these reports of rapists and predators, and what were you told to do with them?
I mean, we would do our best to keep them off the sites, but I mean, when you look on the internet, you'll see pickup artist forums and all sorts of things which are just instructing people how to game the system, how to use the site to pick people up. And I don't know, we catered to, say, the BDSM community a lot, so there would be a lot of predators under the guise of BDSM people. So we'd be seeing an awful lot of stuff, and I don't think the people who were running safety at the group level understood anything about the actual dating sites. And I think that was one of the big problems. They didn't understand dating sites. They understood safety, they understood security, but they didn't understand the audience and who we were dealing with. Our job as a dating site is to make two people who don't know each other and don't know anything about each other meet up in person, and that's dangerous.
You write in the investigation, repeatedly we found users soon after being banned could create new Tinder accounts with the exact same name, birthday. We just talked about that. Michael, ultimately, the people most concerned about safety were forced out of places like, and people might just be shocked that all of these apps are owned by the same group, by Match Group, Match.com, Tinder, Hinge, OkCupid, where you worked as head of user safety.
Yeah, I mean, we had our entire customer service team leave in a single week. All the women left in one day because of basically just internal abuse, like bad abuse. So it was aimed at them and they just all left. And then all the males in the customer service team left in protest within the next week. So they were never refilled. I mean, we replaced that team of, what, 8 or 9 with one person who had no background, no institutional knowledge. I think I calculated we'd lost about 99 years of institutional knowledge in 1 week. Me leaving lost 10. There was just no institutional knowledge left. And it takes a long time to train an investigator in a dating site. For a start, you've got an intimate knowledge of dating sites, an intimate knowledge of your target audience, who you're actually looking after. For customer service people who are talking to sexual assault victims, they've got to be trained in that. They've got to be practiced in that. They've got to realize that only 2% of sexual assault victims are probably going to report it to the police. It's a tiny amount. So what your job is to get them off the site. You can't talk somebody into going to the police. So it's a bad job because you're always losing anyway. We know we can't do that much, but we do the best we can.
How do people protect themselves? I mean, these days you either meet someone online or on a line. But that online, as you're describing, you have Match Group saying, we recognize our role in fostering safer communities and promoting authentic and respectful connections worldwide. We'll always work to invest in and improve our systems and search for ways to help our users stay safe, both online and when they connect in real life. We take every report of misconduct seriously and vigilantly remove and block accounts that have violated our rules regarding this behavior, Match Group said in a statement. You say, in fact, Michael, this isn't true.
They do try. I mean, we've got to give them credit. OkCupid worked for years to try and do this. But when you're having your staff gutted, I mean, even Match Group's team, I think they just fired every single investigator nearly a few months ago, actually. There is a brilliant legal team within Match.com, within Match Group, who deal with all of this, and they've been doing it for longer than me. I mean, most of the people in that legal team have been doing it for 15, 20 years now.
We're going to have to leave it there, but I want to end by asking Emily, do you hold out hope in this last 10 seconds for things to be improved?
I'm kind of a cynic. I think people just need to be careful out there. The person you're matching with might not be who they seem.
Okay, Emily Elena Dugdale, independent investigative reporter Michael Lowry, former OkCupid head of user security. I want to thank you both very much, and we'll link to the report, Rape Under Wraps. That does it for our show. A fond farewell to Hannah Elias, our video fellow. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
You are listening to WRCT 88.3 FM, broadcasting from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. In just a few seconds, Pinckney Hall will begin.
She came to New York, Saks Cafe in Manhattan, coffee and cigarettes and talk, sun beaten down on the east side, introductions are made in the haze. Emma, meet Alexander. Emma just smiles as she says,
save my life. I'll save.
Kenny Joe here. You're in Pinckney Hall on WRCT Pittsburgh, Valentine's Day 2025. For the most part, what we'll be doing today is playing songs appropriate for the holiday. Starting it off with Chumbawamba doing When Alexander Met Emma off of a sing-song and a scrap. For those of you that don't know, that's Alexander Berkman and Emma Goldman. And if you want to know more about that, you can always look it up on the internet, right? Yeah, so that's kicks off Valentine's Day for us. Now, let's see. What are we going to do? We're going to give you a couple of PSAs, but before we do that, a couple of newsy things.